Ever since Beef Wellington became a murder weapon, I've been wondering, what's up with mushrooms? Hello, Anne Jones here from What the Duck, and I'm trying to work out why would fungi be so poisonous that it can kill you? And death caps in particular, why are you so, apparently, delicious? What do you want, to be eaten or not? To find out, search for What the Duck and look for mushrooms. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
So, I want to talk this week about a very, very, very boring meeting and why it might matter more than a lot of the noise, the hyperventilation and headlines coming out of Trump world.
Yes, while we were all preoccupied with what was happening in Washington, behind closed doors, Xi Jinping was holding this very important meeting.
And it offers us a rare glimpse inside the decisions being made at the heart of one of the world's two great powers.
These are decisions that will inevitably affect us all. So let's take a peek behind the curtain, shall we?
I'm Hamish McDonald.
And I'm Geraldine Doogue. This is Global Roaming.
So let's deal with it up front. The Trump-Albanese meeting, Geraldine, this was big news for Australia. What did you make of it?
Oh, I thought it was an extraordinary success for Australia, actually. The anxieties around this meeting were quite something to behold. And I did think, you know, Albanese didn't have to display sycophancy, which I think Australians would have absolutely hated. I think he looked real, Albanese, in dealing with Trump. And I actually thought Trump sort of looked slightly different. You and I have talked about
this. He was relaxed in a way that you don't often see, right?
Yeah, I did detect that. I thought, gosh, am I kidding myself? But I could see that. And, you know, maybe they were all sort of the sort of hyperventilation of the press pack was quite something to behold. But look, I thought we came out of it very well. And quite frankly, even if it takes a decade, I do think the rare earth stuff and the money going into it is a very good thing for Australia.
So it sets up the conversation that we're going to explore on this episode, which is China, this fourth plenum, which has just unfolded. And I guess this is all taking place ahead of a meeting which has now been confirmed between Trump and Xi Jinping, which will take place next week in South Korea. I thought it was worth looking, though, at the way in which Trump kind of distracts us in so many ways from the China question. We asked our producers to look up what's on the minds of Australians when they're searching for stuff on the internet. Trump actually just totally dominates the news cycle compared to both Xi Jinping and China. If you look at the last 12 months, it's really stark. So searches here for Donald Trump outstrip Xi Jinping consistently upwards of 95% compared with 5%. Which I just think speaks so much. Now, if you change the search conditions and look at Trump versus China, it's slightly more kind of even in that it's Trump 55% and higher. But I think, you know, it kind of reminds me of why we do need to make sure we take the time to really try and understand what is going on in Beijing as well.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And I mean, this plays right into some of the excellent writing that has been around, particularly this year, by people like Adam Tooze, who's an English economic historian, intellectual. He just thinks there's a sort of a denial in the West about the scale of change in China. He did a swing through in August, September, and the modernisation that's underway. 75%, for instance, of all renewable energy is generated by the Chinese, 33% of global emissions. But he actually goes on to say there's a material dethroning of the West's being the central driver of world history, and the West has simply not come to terms with it. Now, those numbers that you just cited would lend weight to that, you know?
Could I set you a challenge? Yes. I said this meeting was very, very, very boring. could you make it interesting for listeners? Well, why does it matter so much?
Look, I think it matters because because it's a regular meeting. This one happens every year, but there's a 5-year...
They call it the fourth plenum?
The fourth plenum, they call the fourth plenum of this central committee. It harks back to all centrally planned economies, like the Soviet Union, who were obsessed with planning cycles, 5-year plans, so they knew where they were going. Whereas we in the West, you see, again, this great difference in sort of value system. We believe in the animal spirits of individual risk-taking and dynamism, and that has served us extremely well. The question is, are the 5-year plans now being devised and will be devised in this plenum, will they fundamentally give China a sort of preeminence? And honestly, that's still to be decided.
Yeah, so I guess one of the other points of focus and speculation ahead of this meeting was whether there might be some succession planning taking place, and we're going to get into that on this episode. To help us really get to grips with what's happening in China and I guess prepare us all for the meeting next week between Trump and Xi, we're turning to Neil Thomas. He's an expert on Chinese politics at the Asia Society's Centre for China Analysis. He is Australian. We're talking to him in Washington. Neil, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we know you're an obsessive China watcher, so this is a question for those of us really that don't look at it quite as closely as you do. Can you explain what this meeting actually is? Why is it so important?
So the fourth plenum is just the annual meeting of the Communist Party Central Committee. And it's significant not because there's any great debate or discussion amongst the members. It really just approves things that have been debated in backroom negotiations in the months leading up. But it's a really important mark of like where Xi wants to go this year compared to last.
You don't make it sound exciting.
It's not.
Why are so many people so exercised by it?
Plenums are useful for the signals they send out, not for what happens at them. So they are kind of the culmination of months, or in this case, actually years of planning. This particular plenum is all about working out what China's next 5-year economic plan is going to say. That'll be for 2026 to 2030. So that's going to have an impact on China's economy, the global economy, for the next half decade. So
that's pretty significant to know where that's going, isn't it?
It is. And we have an initial readout from today or from yesterday, China time. And that suggests that basically China is staying the course. Xi outlined his vision of techno-nationalism and industrial power, dominating supply chains in the last 5-year plan. And the guy's only become more powerful since then. So he's doubling right back down on his original vision for China's economy and his response to a more difficult external environment with the US, continually putting more tariffs, sanctions, export controls on China.
Certainly what did make headlines was the fact that just before the plenum started, or to coincide with it certainly, 9 senior PLA staff were sacked. That's a lot of generals. And quite a lot of people didn't turn up to this plenum, with the great suggestion that there was a sort of a bigger than usual purge underway. What's your reading?
It looks like Xi Jinping is implementing the biggest purge of the Central Committee in the post-Mao era, so since the 1970s. And a lot of that is coming from a sweeping anti-corruption and political investigation in the People's Liberation Army. And it's actually not 100% clear, even to us who follow this on a daily basis, what exactly these generals have done. But what is clear is that they've made Xi unhappy and he's been able to get rid of them, which to me suggests that these are a sign of strength rather than weakness. There's been kind of unprecedented rumors about elite dissent and factional opposition over the last few months. But this plenum to me really puts those to bed and has been clear, I think, from looking at the real evidence for a long, long time that Xi is still large and in charge. And even if this is the lowest ever attendance at a plenum in that period, it's a remarkable assertion of his power rather than his weakness.
I'm curious, even if you don't know the reasons behind what they've done for this, how you view it in terms of the idea of renewal of a system, like when you read about the fall of the Soviet Union, is often in part put down to the fact that it had no ability to kind of cleanse itself of things like corruption, but also, you know, the sort of stale nature of the kind of pipelines of leadership. How do you view it in the China context? Is it actually, whatever the reasons, quite a smart move for the preservation of the CCP?
It's a really important and interesting point. I mean, Xi is obsessed with avoiding the fate of the Soviet Communist Party and also of avoiding the fate of all of China's previous imperial dynasties. He's sat down his top leaders at meetings before and like reeled off every single dynasty in Chinese history and the exact number of years that it lasted before it fell. And just to really underline how much this question plays in his mind, I think it's his number one priority, actually. And his solution that he's put forward over the last few years is what he calls self-revolution, which basically means anti-corruption, political discipline, and yes, renewal to try and get a more competent, more clean, and a more capable cadre of officials who are going to be able to govern China forever. I mean, that's ultimately his goal here.
But this is a tricky thing to pull off, isn't it? Because he's got to, if he really is obsessed with this, he's got to start bringing younger people on, doesn't he? He's 72 now. He looks like a pretty healthy 72. But, I mean, he's got to start grooming people, hasn't he? And take the risk that there will be little groups form around those potential new leaders. He's got to deal with that. Otherwise, he's sort of sabotaging his own great dream, isn't he?
Geraldine, the people I know and work with in their 70s show no sign of slowing down, letting go of anything. They're not interested in what comes next.
Neil, just move on, please.
I'll turn the conversation to where I'm located, the United States, and we can just look at the two last presidents, Donald Trump and Joe Biden, both of whom are older than Xi Jinping. So it certainly seems like he's got a while to go yet. His mother actually is still alive.
Is she?
She's 98, I think. His father died in his late 80s. So the guy's got good genes. So I wouldn't bet against him anytime soon. But you're totally right that whilst, you know, what I outlined before is kind of how maybe she thinks about it, there's all these unintended consequences, right? There's a big question about succession. Will it ever be a good time for him to anoint someone? Because as soon as you tap a successor, they can start developing their own power base. People are looking to them in the future. And also you have all this scrutiny of local officials and party cadres. And that's really had a chilling effect on kind of the flexibility and innovation in the system. Like people are afraid to do things that don't have the explicit blessing of the leader or fit like directly within one of his key policy programs. So it's much harder to, you know, find good solutions to new problems. You have to basically wait for them to come down from the top.
Neil, there've been some very interesting writing this year in particular, I noticed. One, the Adam Tooze, the English economic historian, and he's written a piece that I think has had quite an impact, that understanding China is the master key to understanding modernity. It is the laboratory of organised modernisations more than has ever been seen before and probably will be seen at this level. So you get this, and others have followed him and said, yes, look, the West is in slightly denial of just the sheer scale of what is underway, which again, we've heard about for years. But then you hear an interesting little fact. China apparently, I think last month, tried to bring in a new visa to attract particular sorts of high technology talent. And it caused a big stir on Weibo from the youth, because there's about 20% youth unemployment. And there was really big pushback of people who say, well, we've trained and we can't get jobs in our own country. And you're talking about bringing in people from overseas. So you, like, that was a sort of a real soft underbelly, I thought, to this otherwise staggering story of, you know, huge, huge growth.
It's a very astute comparison. And it's, both things are true, right? China's a big place. It's a complicated place. There's not just one China story. as much as Beijing would like to, you know, tell us there is one China story and it's theirs. So I think, I mean, Adam Tooze is totally right that China genuinely has some incredibly impressive technological and economic achievements. And I mean, I personally think that actually every politician, every staffer should go to China, go to the Huawei factory, go to the CATL factory, and just get a real tangible sense of, you know, what we're up against if we want to compete with China and the scale of investment and policy response that we need to, you know, make sure that our supply chains are more secure. I mean, we're just not seeing anywhere near that level of policy attention to these issues in any capital in the West, I'd say. But at the same time, I mean, China does face huge problems. There's still a lot of poverty in China, maybe not the extreme rural poverty that Xi, you know, claimed to eliminate a few years ago, but...
And saw it himself, of course, when he was banished to the provinces. Very much experienced it.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I think he sincerely, you know, does care about that issue. It's political, but it's also personal for Xi. He is a true believer. But China does have a huge amount of challenges, especially, well, development, but also demographics, right? I mean, the UN projects that China's working age population will shrink from about a billion today to around 700 million by 2050, which is almost an unprecedented collapse in China's working age population. And so, you know, you need productivity to try and get over that. And how are you going to do that? The economy is great in some ways, high-tech manufacturing, but struggling in others. You know, consumption, services, employment, there's still a way to go. So it's easy if you just go to like the big cities to maybe overestimate just how wonderful all of China is. Like any country, it has a lot of problems that it's struggling to overcome.
You're listening to ABC Radio National's Global Roaming with me, Geraldine.
And with me, Hamish McDonald. We're speaking to Neil Thomas about the big political shakeup that's been unfolding in China. But, Jerry, there is a lot more to come in this conversation.
We're about to hear what we might interpret from a conversation between President Trump and our Prime Minister that has raised some eyebrows.
Neil, can I pick up on something you mentioned earlier? And it was in reference to America's approach to what it's doing in relation to trade with China. But I guess the news that we've been talking about here in Australia this week is what China did in the lead up to our Prime Minister's visit to Washington in relation to critical minerals, rare earths, and the export of the processed versions of those. How is Beijing explaining inside China what it's doing on trade?
So the big news, obviously, of today is that, you know, Trump and Xi are going to be meeting in South Korea next Thursday. And I expect the rare earth export controls that you mentioned that China introduced, you know, unprecedented a couple of weeks ago, will be the main topic of conversation. And from China's point of view, the perspective is that, hey, the United States has been doing this to us, for example, with chips, right? Massive semiconductor export controls passed by the Biden administration. So to them, this is just kind of retaliation. This is just trying to get themselves on an equal footing compared to what the United States has been doing in terms of trying to hold back China's economic and technological development. And you know, we can quibble about like whether it's proportionate or not, but I mean, from Beijing's perspective, that's certainly a huge part of their thinking. From their point of view, they're playing catch up with the US when it comes to economic coercion.
So is there a sort of unspoken danger slightly here in Australia, given what's happened this week? You know, the Albanese-Trump meeting was hailed this huge success. But when you consider what we're doing with America on rare earths in the context of the bigger China-US game, are we actually a bit more exposed than what we might be acknowledging at the moment?
China dominates the global supply chains for rare earth mining, refining, magnets. So that is going to take a long time and a lot of money to turn around. But I think the agreement that was announced by Albo and Trump the other day, I mean, that's a good first step, right? I mean, I think the problem's been that policymakers in the West have spent a long time, as someone put it, admiring the problem of rare earth dependency without really doing anything about it. And I think these export controls and some other steps recently have kind of really been the catalyst for people to wake up to just how serious this is and just how dependent we are on China. And you never want to be too dependent on one particular country, especially if they're a strategic rival.
Sorry, can I just jump in? Does that mean then, in your view, you think what Australia is doing with America is offering anyway is so small China doesn't care? Or do you think that we might still be drawn into this competition more so than we would feel comfortable with?
It certainly opens Australia up to potential retaliation, and the proof will be in the pudding of just how Beijing decides to implement these announced controls. So they haven't come into force yet. And do we see Australian firms maybe getting longer delays to get licenses to do rare earth trade? That would be, I think, the big watch point. But it's certainly true that for Xi Jinping, he's in, you know, deal preservation mode when it comes to dealing with President Trump. He's going to be tough, but I think ultimately they want to, you know, keep that negotiation process moving forward. So if you want to express displeasure, the tried and true tactic they've done in the past is to hit out at American allies and partners, basically trying to punish them rather than the United States for what is fundamentally a US-China issue.
Neil, I want to ask you about this meeting that is going to happen between Trump and Xi Jinping in South Korea. But I want to play for listeners a little bit of audio of Trump's interaction with the Australian press at that meeting with Anthony Albanese. Obviously, we know all the headlines that came out of it. Subsequent to the meeting, though, I started getting a lot of messages from people saying, did you hear the bit that he had to say about China and the possibility of taking Taiwan?
We'll be just fine with China. China doesn't want to do that. First of all, the United States is the strongest military power in the world by far. It's not even close. Not even close. We have the best equipment. We have the best of everything. And nobody's going to mess with that. And I don't see that at all with President Xi. I think we're going to get along very well as it pertains to Taiwan and others. Now, that doesn't mean it's not the apple of his eye, because probably it is. But I don't see anything happening.
So, Neil, what did you make of that? How does that, in your mind, set up this meeting that is going to happen?
I admire President Trump's confidence, but I'd say that the military balance is pretty close in the Indo-Pacific when you come to comparing the US and China, especially across the Taiwan Strait. Taiwan's a whole lot closer to mainland China than it is to the continental United States. But I think where Trump's sentiment is maybe slightly better placed is that I don't think Xi Jinping wants to launch an invasion across the strait anytime soon. He wants to do everything he can to avoid that because he knows how costly it will be. His preference is to incrementally coerce Taiwan militarily, economically, politically, to basically come to the negotiating table and work out a Hong Kong-type arrangement. Mm-hmm. And so part of that is trying to deter the United States from increasing its own support for Taiwan to basically try and make Taiwanese give up hope that they'd have a savior were China to ever to pull the trigger. And so I think while the words that Trump says, like does he come out and say that the US opposes rather than does not support Taiwanese independence are important, they're not as important as ensuring that the United States and its allies like Australia retain a robust presence militarily in the Indo-Pacific and are prepared to put that muscle into military deterrence to ensure that, you know, Xi Jinping wakes up every day and never thinks that looks like it's easy to invade Taiwan.
Yes, an ex-senior diplomat just said to me yesterday, Neil, that he thinks the whole framing of Australia and China as sort of this notion that they're going to invade is completely wrong. And it sidelined us that, in fact, China wants to dominate the area with its ideas and its plans. And that's what we've got to engage with.
When it comes to Australia, I think the idea that China wants to invade us is ludicrous. And is something that would involve China having to basically invade every other country in between them and us to be able to pull it off. But the idea that China wants to become a regional hegemon, absolutely. They basically say as much in the party discourse and debates around foreign policy. And you know, if you're China, why wouldn't you? Of course, you want to be as powerful a country as you can. And yeah, it's
and bring their values to the table, which may not be ours. I think that was his follow-up line. That's the tricky challenge. That's an intellectual challenge and a sort of cultural challenge.
Yeah, bringing their values to global governance and making international norms look more like China than the West. That's not going to mean that China is going to impose its system of government on us. And even during the height of the US-led international order, that didn't make China a democracy, right? I mean, the US tried really hard actually to do that and it failed. And I think if China really put its mind to trying to make America or Australia or the Britain into a communist country, it would also really, really struggle to do that because we don't want to be communist countries. So I think that dimension of the threat is massively overhyped. But even just in the last couple of years, Xi Jinping has begun rolling out a whole series of initiatives, like global governance initiatives, that really kind of distill a lot of Chinese foreign policy thinking into a set of neat concepts about how they want the world to work. So a security architecture without American alliances, a values architecture that puts collective over individual rights, a development landscape that leans more towards states than markets. And that's like the challenge, it's out there. And China's doing all it can to become a more powerful actor in global governance. And if Washington and other Western capitals don't put in the effort or even step back from those institutions, then China's going to have a much easier time becoming their leader.
Neil Thomas, thank you.
Thanks for having me. And hopefully see you next time I'm in Sydney.
Well, your thoughts, Geraldine?
Well, I thought particularly that reference to the Chinese now wanting to impose or sort of suggest, shall we say, their value systems on the world was fascinating. I thought he put that very well, and that in fact, if the West says, "Oh well, we'll just retreat from these things because they don't work," like I suppose world trade authorities and courts and so on, well, that'll just make it much easier for them. I just think this whole reframing to get away from the militaristic idea myself to this actually bigger cultural challenge. That's what I took from that.
There is danger, though, isn't there, in totally getting away from the military side of it, because the military buildup that China's undergoing is real, and there is a danger in being too distracted from that, isn't there?
I don't know. I mean, I think that we're putting an enormous amount of money into that particular anxiety, and I'm not sure it's well spent. I don't know whether they are immensely, territorially aggressive. I've never been persuaded that they were, but I've got an open mind, but I haven't seen evidence of it.
Do you have an open mind on that?
Yeah, I do. I think I do. Because, anybody who knows anything about history knows about, the Germans rebuilding and everybody, people like Churchill said, we can't take our eyes off them. But honestly, Nazi Germany did have overt aggressive tendencies. I can't see it from China,
How do you place the South China Sea in that picture?
But that's all part of defending their homeland. That's a different thing, I think.
But if you're Indonesian or if you're Filipina, you might view that quite differently.
Filipinos might. Indonesians don't, I don't think. I mean, if you look at it, I just think if you look at their history, I think they're getting back to where they've got dignity. But I don't particularly think they've been aggressive.
But laying claim to other people's territory based on dynastic history, I mean, that is more than just asserting one's homeland.
But where's that happened particularly? I mean, they've taken things that I've not don't support it, but I can. It's a bit like
The nine dash line was drawn on a piece of paper. I mean, and that is their claim. That's what all of this is based on.
Yeah, but it's very close to them, and they get an enormous amount of material that they have to import. So it's understandable strategically, I think. I don't like it, but it's understandable. It doesn't suggest aggressively taking over lots of other land, I don't think. I've never thought that. But look, Hamish, you have you keep to your thoughts. I have never been persuaded of it.
We may not resolve it on this episode of Global
Guess
Roaming.
What? We won't.
Before we get to recommendations, Jerry, there's some really lovely feedback this week that we did want to share.
It's a gorgeous email from a longtime Roma named Bridie. Now, Bridie listens from Darwin, and she first wrote to us a year ago after the arrival of her newborn, Bob, one of those lovely short names. We read her email at the time. She was listening to Global Roaming during some of those sleepless nights, as well as binging shows like Emily in Paris and The Perfect Couple. Now, we recently received another email from Bridie, who was still listening to the show. I think you should take it away.
She says, almost a year on, I'm still listening, waiting for your podcast episode to drop every Friday. Of course, I'm still balancing my appetite for global affairs with good trash TV. I just devoured season 3 of The Summer I Turned Pretty. Not as vacuous as it sounds, but almost, exclamation mark. Thank you for bringing the world to my ears, Bridie. It's an absolute pleasure. Happy birthday to Bob. We really appreciate that you're still listening and corresponding with us, and we look forward to the next email.
Now, recommendations, Hamish.
Well, on the subject of binging television, I'm going to recommend the new season of The Diplomat, which has just exploded, I think is probably a way to describe this new season. Kerry Russell back playing the US ambassador to London. And for people that adored The West Wing, and I suspect some of our listeners were West Wing fans, there's a special treat in this because Alison Janney, who played the vice president in the last, well, she was CJ in The West Wing. She was the vice president in the previous seasons of The Diplomat. She's now in a new role and there is a new character. And I'm just going to lay this
you're
as an Easter
egg. You're just going to drop that.
If you loved The West Wing, there's just a lovely little surprise.
I think Rufus Sewell is one of the great draw cards of The Diplomat. Actually, it's funny. I started The Diplomat and I found it earlier on. I just found some of the – I just couldn't get into the plots. You know, I could see the cleverness of it and, you know, her with all her messiness and all of that. I understood that, but I thought, oh, no, because there was another English thing called The Diplomat, which I also watched, which I thought was – anyway, slightly better. Well, look, I'm also going to recommend something from the cinematic excitement, The House of Dynamite, which is the new Catherine Bigelow film.
Okay.
Catherine Bigelow of Hurt Locker, Zero Dark Thirty, and she, it is a fantastically well done thriller. Yeah, it's pretty dark too, but it's really reminding us that we take nuclear proliferation for granted these days. I think it's gone on to Netflix now. I saw it on the big screen. It's a fantastic soundtrack. Absolutely. If that man doesn't win an Oscar, I'll be amazed. But my God, that woman knows how to do a narrative with momentum. It's really fantastic.
Never would have picked you for a blockbuster.
Well, look, I'm not a blockbuster tragic, but Catherine Bigelow, I'll go to anything Catherine Bigelow makes. So,
global.roaming@abc.net.au is our email address. Please keep the emails coming. Wherever you're listening, please leave us a star rating, a comment. We love that support. Thanks to our producer, Taryn Priadko. Jerry, see you next time.
Bye-bye, Hamish.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.